Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Sorry for the slight delay, but we're delighted you all came. We're taking advantage of Astrid Tumenez being in town, coming all the way in from Hong Kong where she now lives, which is much easier for me because she can get to the Philippines in 2 hours, whereas it takes me, about 24 hours to get there. So it relieves some of the pressure on me. But I'm Gene Martin, for those of you who don't know, and we run the, Astrid and I together, run the Philippine Facilitation Project here at the Institute. Astrid is our senior research associate, has worked with representatives of the Philippine government, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, mass media and civil society to strengthen support for a settlement of the conflict in Mindanao. Her research has covered negotiations on ancestral domain, self-determined governance, Moro history, Moro unity and leadership, and questions of terrorism. She's also a senior fellow at the Southeast Asian Research Center at the City University of Hong Kong. Astrid has far too long a bio to read to everybody, so I will just say that she's got a distinguished career, comes from Iloilo initially, but has become an adoptive daughter of Mindanao. So with that, I will introduce Astrid, please.
Thank you. Earlier today, I practiced standing here, and I asked Gene, can you see me? So I called my talk today Theater of the Absurd, the Philippines 20 Years After Marcos. I'm not an expert on the Theater of the Absurd, a tradition which arose after World War II, but I was reading descriptions of this on the Internet, and one analyst says that in the Theater of the Absurd, life's meaning is portrayed as absurd, and man often feels bewildered, troubled, and obscurely threatened. This phrase sums up my feelings about the Philippines 20 years after the overthrow of Ferdinand Marcos. Marcos's arguably more notorious half, Imelda, has come up with her own aphorisms to rival those of experts on absurdist theater. In 1982, making a case for the Manila International Film Festival to be held in the Philippines, she said, "The Philippines is in a strategic position. It is both east and west, right and left, rich and poor. We are neither here nor there." Notwithstanding the bewildering, troubling, obscurely threatening, and neither here nor there nature of Philippine affairs, my task today is to try and analyze the path the country has trod in the past 20 years, assess how matters stand today, and make some tentative conclusions on whether or not the Philippines is forever doomed to an absurd fate, or whether it has hope of shaping a better future for its citizens. If we had a screen showing flashback of the last 20 years since Marcos was overthrown, the top of that screen might read, 20 years of living dangerously. In February 1986, when Marcos was indeed overthrown, few people thought of danger. The future looked bright for the country, and the world looked on with nearly hagiographic admiration as Corazon Aquino, widow of the martyred Senator Benigno Aquino, with the backing of about 1 million Filipinos on EDSA highway in Manila, managed to lead the improbable overthrow of the two-decades-old regime of Ferdinand Marcos. Many of us might remember the spectacle of the Marcoses being loaded off with all the wealth they could carry onto an American helicopter en route to exile in Hawaii. Then came spectacles of demonstrators traipsing through Malacañang Palace, and the discovery of thousands of 8.5 size shoes, a bulletproof bra, and gallons of perfume left behind by Imelda. These images, particularly to Filipinos like myself, signaled unbelievable change. I grew up under martial law and was a student activist at the University of the Philippines when I was a teenager. The overthrow of Marcos was something incredible, and many then believed that a revolution had taken place, a genuine and irrevocable break from a past marked by oppression of the many by the corrupt and powerful few. Unfortunately, the years since 1986 have shown that no real revolution has taken place. Marcos's downfall, in my opinion, was but a brief interlude when Philippine traditional elites became temporarily dazed, but returned later with clear heads on their shoulders and ready to take up where they had left off. It may be useful to review what's happened just in the administrations since President Marcos. The presidency of Cory Aquino from 1986 to 1992, while laden with hopes, ultimately turned out to be a disappointment. She accomplished some things, including restoring a more democratic government recovering some of the Marcos fortune, overseeing a respectable growth rate for a few years, and enhancing the image of the Philippines abroad. Overall, however, her government turned out to be too weak and incompetent to reform the Philippine system effectively. She was unable to capitalize on all the popular and international support at the beginning of her presidency to take bold steps that would set the tone for her rule. Her authority was repeatedly challenged by Marcos loyalists, turncoats in her cabinet, and the military. And I think many of us will remember that there were 7 coup attempts against Cory Aquino. Her physical and political survival hung in the balance many times. The fact that as president she couldn't get to the bottom of who ordered her own husband's murder was to me symptomatic of the limited nature of change after Marcos. Her land reform program failed, and efforts to reform the army and military, which had a long tradition of exercising raw power and corrupt law enforcement, also were incomplete, and this tradition haunts haunts the country to this day. A full accounting of human rights abuses, corruption, and thievery under the Marcos regime never took place. And the judiciary and bureaucracy, which always favored powerful clans and individuals, remained as before. It's interesting, I think, that those elites who left the Philippines during the overthrow of Marcos soon came back. And if you were to return to Manila some years after Marcos left, you'd see the same parties. And I think the same people who, you know, were happy to scratch each other's backs and forgive each other's sins. After Aquino came Fidel Ramos, whose time in power marked what I would argue were the most hopeful 6 years in the post-Marcos period. Although Ramos was a member of the Marcos strongman team, he redeemed himself by siding with People Power in 1986. And as we know, it was really his defection, along with then-Defense Secretary Juan Ponce Enrile, that sealed the end of the Marcos dictatorship. An engineer by training, a West Point graduate, and a very well-known workaholic, Ramos had the requisite qualities of a leader who was feared, who was skilled, and who was competent. Under his presidency, important reforms occurred, including the dismantling of monopolies, removing of tariffs to enhance competitiveness in the Philippine economy, the privatizing of government-owned corporations, building and improving roads, bridges, ports, and other key infrastructure, and the negotiation and signing of a peace agreement with the largest Muslim insurgency in the Philippines, the Moro National Liberation Front. Ramos also embarked on a professionalization of the bureaucracy and launched efforts to mitigate corruption in the government. But his efforts were not entirely successful, and his own administration and he himself were not immune to accusations of graft and corruption. But undeniably, it was during Ramos's terms that many Filipinos felt a surge of hope. Structural change was taking place, and many began to believe that a qualitatively better foundation was being laid for the country's future. Alas, all of this prematurely ended because the constitution that was written after Marcos gave presidents of the Philippines only 1 6-year term, so Ramos did not have the time to carry out all the reforms he had in mind. After him, of course, onto the stage comes our famous bumbling and often drunk president, the Philippine Robin Hood, Joseph Estrada, also popularly known as Erap. President Estrada, famous star of 107 Philippine action movies, an open womanizer and self-branded savior of the masses, came into power in 1998 with the biggest margin in any Philippine presidential election. He won 39% of votes in a very crowded field of candidates and wasted no time dismantling the reforms begun by Ramos. Many analysts credit Estrada with the return of cronyism and influence peddling. He restored control over large corporations to his cronies, ended major tax evasion charges against his friends, and allegedly engaged in stock manipulation and insider trading that nearly brought the Philippine Stock Exchange to a collapse. And when his approval ratings dove, he didn't hesitate to launch an all-out war against the Muslims in Mindanao to resuscitate his authority and reputation. 31 months into his presidency, allegations of corruption and gambling racketeering led to the unraveling of Estrada's presidency. And that I think he is still under house arrest at the moment. The military refused to back Estrada when the controversy was going on over allegations of corruption in his presidency. And in early 2001, the Supreme Court declared his then Vice President, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, as the new Commander-in-Chief. President Arroyo, today, if she serves out her term through 2010, will be the president with the longest time in power since Marcos. She will have had nearly 10 years by the time she finishes. It is too early to sum up her accomplishments and failings, but suffice it to say that the years of living dangerously after Marcos continue also to mark her rule. She is to be credited recently for improving the Philippine fiscal situation, but it is uncertain what other policies and reforms she can push through in a current sea of opposition. She faces multiple challenges, including terrorist bombings, a communist insurgency, a Muslim insurgency, and a military given to occasional rebellion and mutiny. Allegations of cheating at the 2004 polls and accusations of corruption against her husband and son have weakened her credibility and alienated many citizens. President Arroyo's declaration of a state of emergency 4 months ago, in my view, is symptomatic of how harassed and besieged her presidency is, and it also indicated how the appearance of calm and stability could very easily and quickly be broken in the Philippines within a short period of time. So given this 20-year history, where does the Philippines stand today? And I'll say a few words about politics, security, and economics. In real ways, we can argue that the Philippines is better off today than it was 20 or 21 years ago. Positive changes in the sphere of human rights and civil society are perhaps the most striking, albeit marred. As a teenager during martial law, there is nothing that I can compare. I was not even a teenager, I think 8 years old. And then, but, you know, grew up there under martial law. There is nothing today that I can compare to the repression, the killings, the political arrest, torture, disappearances, and salvaging that was routine under the Marcos dictatorship. If anyone needs elaboration, salvaging, that's the practice of torturing, mutilating, and killing people and leaving their bodies by the roadside as an example to the rest of the population. Today, the Philippines has an active free press, an empowered and energetic civil society, and a government that does not exercise the violent excesses on the scale of the old regime. But these political gains are offset by unpleasant facts. For example, freedom of the press is seriously undermined by the fact that the Philippines is second only to Iraq as the most dangerous place for journalists. 2 weeks ago, when I was in Cagayan de Oro, another journalist was gunned down in Palawan. He had investigated allegations of corruption there, and he was on his way to work and was simply shot to death. Now, he makes the 79th journalist killed in the Philippines since Marcos was overthrown 20 years ago. As far as the human rights situation, the constitutionally mandated Commission on Human Rights declared in 2005 that the Philippine National Police was the worst abuser of Filipino human rights. Democracy also remains dysfunctional. Political parties and political programs are weak, thus creating non-cohesive political leadership. Dynasties, political clans, and personalities continue to dominate national politics. And this is illustrated well in the 2004 presidential and congressional elections. When you see the roster of names of the winners, Rojas Osmeña, Madrigal, Barbers, Magsaysay, Recto, and Macapagal, you can conclude to yourself that the names just recycle, basically over decades and decades of Philippine elections. Family political machines continue to be well-oiled, and those with access to family fortunes can still fairly easily get themselves prominent positions in the halls of political power. Of course, not all the dynasties are old. There are some new ones, which have arisen since I left the Philippines, and these are the movie star dynasties. And you see that in the Senate, former movie stars, I am just shocked. They're mayors, governors, and senators. And, of course, our former president was an actor. Another sign of dysfunctional democracy concerns participation. Again, we look to the 2004 elections to illustrate this. The good news was there was high voter turnout of over 36 million, or 81% of eligible voters. However, violence and corruption marred the process. Approximately 150 election-related fatalities occurred, including 30 that happened the week after the elections themselves, when losers take revenge against the winners. While some politicians and other government affiliates underscored that the greatest threat to elections would come from renegade groups such as the Abu Sayyaf or the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, it turned out that much of the violence was between local competitors. In the province of Isabela, the Board of Canvassers opted to quit in fear of violent reprisal from the incumbent governor, who was losing by 40,000 votes. The winning candidate had to go into hiding until she was finally declared the victor. Corruption was also rampant, with vote buying and bribery widely observed. Many candidates illegally used government funds, infrastructure, and resources to push forward their campaigns. There were few, if any, financial or accounting systems to ensure that candidates observed spending limits. And some who campaigned in NPA, the communist insurgency, in NPA-dominated areas actually gave money, guns, and cell phones to the communist insurgents in exchange for votes. Finally, the old Filipino practice of dagdag bawas, or add-subtract, proved alive and well. In one municipality in Sultan Kudarat in Mindanao, where there were only 300 registered voters, President Arroyo got 1,000 votes. Let me now say a few words about security. The security situation in the Philippines is unstable, though arguably not as deplorable as it was under Marcos and other presidents when hot wars raged between the government and various insurgencies. The 70s were certainly worse. That was when 100,000 or more people died, for example, in the Moro conflict. But challenges remain today. Foremost is the communist insurgency, which has already claimed 40,000 lives. I'm a former Sovietologist, and it's ironic to me that the Philippines still has this communist movement when elsewhere in the large sponsor states, communism isn't a big deal or is practically dead. In 1990, the New People's Army was estimated to have between 18 to 23,000 members, but these dwindled under Marcos and Ramos and Aquino, and also because the NPA had an internal purge. They were looking for five traitors, agents for the government amongst their ranks, and they ended up killing hundreds, if not thousands, of their own people. But the NPA is present. There are now 7,000 to 9,000 of them, and they are present in 69 of the 79 provinces of the Philippines. This kind of presence throughout the archipelago is impressive. They've also proven effective at waging low-intensity conflict. Since January of this year, for example, the Philippine police reports that NPA forces had raided 9 police stations, seized 100 weapons, and all this without firing a shot. Driven by rural discontent, injustice, police and military brutality, and deep social inequity, it is unlikely that the communist rebellion will fade away soon. And because the NPA is listed as a foreign terrorist organization, negotiations between it and the Philippine government have stalled since 2004. Another challenge to security is the Muslim insurgency, and Jean and I, of course, have worked on that for the last 3 years, and maybe during the question and answer session we could discuss that in greater detail. But this rebellion, Moro Rebellion, is over 3 decades old, has claimed over 120,000 lives, and has cumulatively displaced millions of people during years of on and off again fighting. The conflict, according to the most recent UN Philippine Human Development Report, has cost the country an average of 5 to 10 billion pesos yearly since 1975. Although the Philippine government has signed many agreements, including 2 major peace agreements in 1976 and 1996, the conflict continues because of the absence of effective structures and arrangements to address the Moro's legitimate long-term grievances. For example, according to the 2005 UN Human Development Report, anti-Moro prejudice among Christian Filipinos remains widespread and powerful in fanning the flames of conflict. The Arroyo administration has been in peace talks with the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, the biggest and largest holdout group among Moro rebels. These talks began in 2001 and have yielded genuine progress. Foremost is a ceasefire overseen by Malaysia, Brunei, and Libya that has lasted for 3 years now. On the technical front, the government and MILF peace panels have worked diligently and effectively to begin resolving thorny issues related to Muslim ancestral lands, control over economic resources, and potential government arrangements that would give Moros maximum authority. While all of this deserves praise, there is a big piece nonetheless that's missing, the critical variable, and I think that is the ability of the current administration, President Arroyo, to sign and implement, more importantly, implement an agreement effectively in the face of what I see now as serious opposition. Another challenge to security is terrorism by local and foreign perpetrators. Deadly bombings have become all too common, including one of the deadliest terrorist bombings since 9/11, carried out on a ferry boat in Manila in 2004 that killed over 100 people. Weak law enforcement, poor intelligence, widespread corruption and incompetence, political rivalries, and a Muslim insurgency that outsiders have exploited are all factors in creating and fueling terrorism. Arrests have been made, but there have really been very few trials in the Philippines. And terrorists have escaped from prison, Camp Krami, in broad daylight. Bombings of marshes where terrorists are supposed to be hiding have killed people, but not the terrorists targeted. A good example of this is the Butilan Marsh, which has been bombed at least 3 times. And each time, 10 to 19 people killed, and they could never find Dulmatin, the Indonesian that they're after, on whose head there's also a $10 million bounty. Let me now say something about the economy. Many economists applaud the recent direction of the Philippines, particularly improvements in the country's fiscal order. The government has collected more taxes, cut expenditures, and lowered the budget deficit. The peso has strengthened and is projected to strengthen further in 2006 and 2007. Overseas foreign worker remittances continue to set record highs, accounting in 2005 for 11% of the Philippine GDP and driving consumption-led growth in the country. So the malls are always full in the Philippines. But there is a dark side to the Philippine economy. Corruption is rampant and the playing field in the private sector remains skewed. Transparency International has ranked the Philippines number 117 out of 159 countries surveyed in 2005, at par with Afghanistan, Uganda, Libya, and Guatemala. In Southeast Asia, the Philippines is ranked as the second most corrupt country after Indonesia. Massive numbers of Filipinos are still mired in poverty, with between 40 to 60% of the population living below the poverty line, defined as $2 a day. Income distribution remains highly unequal, with the top 10% enjoying 40% of household income and consumption, and the lowest 10% getting by on 1.7% of household income. In a survey 2 years ago, 34% of Filipinos, a new high, were pessimistic about their prospects. In the same year, a third of families nationally acknowledged that they had inadequate food, so hunger is a big problem in the Philippines. Many families also implode emotionally and socially because of the absence of parents who are working abroad to earn money. Pessimism and cynicism abound, and this despite, you know, surveys that say Filipinos are the happiest people in Asia. Add to this the continued population growth of 2.3% a year. It is sobering to think that the Philippines has had a fourfold increase in population in 50 years, from 20 million in 1950 to over 85 million today. These statistics connote that underneath the facade of temporary economic stability and growth are potential explosive social and demographic factors. And when you add to this political and security risk, it becomes a bit difficult to fight skepticism about the Philippine economy. We now come to a key question in the last part of my presentation today. Is the Philippines doomed to this meaningless cycle of mediocrity, to being neither here nor there, as Imelda Marcos said? The reasonable answer is yes, based on what I have said so far, and perhaps the correct answer is yes. Many Filipinos already feel this way, as evidenced by the mass exodus of about 2,500 people every day. But let me conclude with a somewhat hopeful and maybe contrarian proposition. It is the argument that the Philippines is not doomed because, in my opinion, all the country needs is a few leaders, and I will elaborate on this, and a very good leader at the top to tackle effectively some of its most serious problems. In light of this proposition, let me quote President Ramos. He said, "Where government is weak or even failing is where political will and leadership must come in. Because whatever system of government, whatever the historical experience or the cultural endowments of the country are, it is still the leaders that must carry the ball, see the vision, promulgate the strategy, and carry out the tactics so that the nation, the people, the country can go there." I think Ramos astutely pinned down the most critical variable, leadership. Filipinos may be quarrelsome and unruly. Their culture may be damaged, as James Fallows argued in 1987, and the country may be a mess overall. But, and I think this is extremely important, under good leadership, Filipinos have proven the ability to follow and deliver the goods. Human talent, educated, energetic, and hungry for rewards, abounds in the Philippines. The country is rich in natural endowments, including abundant tourist-worthy sites, mineral deposits, including potentially substantive oil and gas reserves and fertile land. And I've done a little bit more work on this because I recently was asked by an investment bank in Hong Kong to give a presentation to their money managers on Mindanao in particular. And this is where it dawned on me that, in fact, all the natural resources are there to make this country very rich. So what is the data to prove that there might be some truth to the proposition that I have just made? I'll give three examples of this variable of leadership, why it matters so much and why it makes a huge difference in a fairly short amount of time. At the national level, I'll give examples at the national, regional, and local levels. At the national level, Fidel Ramos stands out. He was not perfect, but his single six-year term showed how much positive change can be wrought in the country by one leader with a sharp brain, solid political instincts, and a track record that made his potential detractors respect, if not fear, him. And I want to emphasize the fear factor. It works in the Philippines. I think it's very important. Ramos did not revolutionize Philippine culture, but he changed enough structures and incentives to elicit behaviors that led to positive political, economic, and security outcomes. At the regional level, I would speak about the leaders of Cebu and Davao cities. Cebu, which is located about an hour south of Manila, has been led for decades by the Osmeña clan and a few other families. Taking advantage of powers devolved to local leaders, Cebu's politicians launched a program of impressive growth in the 1980s and 1990s. Cebu was responsible for 10% of all Philippine exports by 1994, and leaders managed to attract a large amount of foreign investment in tourism and export processing zones. Cebu's Mactan Export Processing Zone, for example, grew its clients from 10 firms in 1987 to over 100 in 2001, employing 36,000 workers. Also impressive is the partnership that Cebuano political leaders have forged with NGOs, which they have tapped to help deliver social services more effectively to the poor and to help give a voice to the concerns of urban communities. The track record in Cebu is not perfect, and corruption and cronyism, of course, are there as problems, and poverty remains widespread. But development in Cebu in the last two decades has given many Cebuanos employment, hope, and pride. And it is particular to me just such a stark contrast, because as a child when I traveled to Cebu, that was not an impressive place at all. And you go there now and you do feel a sense of vibrance that was just hard to imagine 20 years ago. The experience of Davao City also is tantalizing, if somewhat perturbing. In the 1970s and 1980s, Davao, by the way, is consistently the most competitive city in the Philippines. In the 1970s and 1980s, Davao was a sprawling capital of crime and murder, with a population facing the virulent onslaught of the communists, of the New People's Army, the Moro Rebellion, and corrupt and incompetent government and security forces. The tide turned after the election in 1987 of Mayor Rodrigo Duterte, Jean's good friend, a vigilante for peace and order. Dubbed as the Punisher, Duterte's regime ignored due process. Remember I said the fear factor earlier was important. He ignored due process and ruthlessly cleaned the city of its criminal elements, including teenagers who were alleged repeated offenders in robbery or drug-related crimes. Today, Davao City has the lowest per capita crime rate in the country. Its economy is growing. It's about $2 billion in size, and its population thriving. Although on occasion, Davao still witnesses security setbacks, such as the bombing of its airport and one of its wharves in 2003, these are rare and have not derailed the city's attraction for business people, visitors, and workers. Duterte has served three terms as mayor, and he was forced to leave by law. He became a congressman and was reelected again as mayor in 2001. And the people love him in Davao, and most people, when they go to Davao City, they obey the rules. Now, the question, of course, in the future is how much of Davao's progress is due to the specifically individual politician, or is it being institutionalized now so that when Duterte leaves the scene, Davao can maintain the progress that it's made. Finally, at the local level, I will talk about Datu Toto Paglas, who has been a guest here at the U.S. Institute of Peace and whose plantation Jean and I have visited. Dato Paglas is a clan leader in the municipality of Paglas, which is named after his ancestors in the province of Maguindanao, and he's become somewhat of an international celebrity because of what he's done. He lost his father and three brothers to violence and lawlessness in Mindanao, but decided at some point that he's got to do something better for his people, so he approached John Perrine, who is an investor who's lived in the Philippines and invested in plantations for a long time. And John tells him, Toto, I've never invested in Muslim lands. I have no Muslim friends. All my Christian friends tell me I cannot trust you. And Toto said, shake my hand. I will protect your investment with my life. And John Perrine was so moved, he committed right there and then to put $25 million into the municipality of Paglas. Paglas was a town where people would not drive through after 4 p.m. because ambushes, kidnapping, rapes were rampant. So when this plantation started, what Datu Paglas did, and he was ruthless, by the way. He was mayor at 25, has had a reputation for killing people himself, but really turned around. And, you know, this is sort of a religious experience for him, where he said Allah spoke to him and he's got to do something different. So he hired all the kidnappers, all the former rebels, and they started this banana plantation. They asked people to put their land together into a large plantation. The planters would come in every day with huge rifles on their shoulders. And he had to tell them, you can't do that. Don't bring your weapons to work. And so the next day they came without their weapons to work, but behind them were their wives and children carrying the weapons. So this was rough going at first, but eventually, you know, things began to improve. He brought in Israeli technicians. He went to a kibbutz in Israel, studied there, brought back drip irrigation technology. And today this plantation and sister plantation in another province have become the second most productive plantation for Chiquita bananas. Over $65 million has been invested. Thousands have been employed. And when war broke out in 2002 and 2003 in Mindanao, none of the guerrillas who were working on his plantation returned to the battlefield. So you know, I'd like to discuss this with you in Q&A. I'm done, so you don't have to listen to me anymore. but I do think the leadership factor, and I think the toughest question now is, where will this leadership come from? And that's something that I'm looking at. Because this is the variable that will take the Philippines out of where it is. And I think it's lagging and lagging and lagging if this leadership isn't found. It is there, as in the examples I've given. The danger for the Philippines is, does it become an eternal laggard if leaders don't show up in the next 5 to 10 years? I will end here and be happy to answer questions or ask you questions.
Take some questions, and please identify yourself and ask your question. Sir.
Yeah. David Grant, Nonviolent Peace Force. I was in the Philippines 81 to 83 with the Peace Corps on Mount Pinatubo with the ITA. And I must say that having been there again a couple of times for Nonviolent Peace Force to go to Mindanao, the numbers of armed private security people don't seem that greatly different than 20-plus years ago. But my main question has to do with Mindanao, and it was said to me when I was there a couple of times that even if a solid peace agreement is arranged with MILF, other spoilers will come along in the same way that MILF was the spoiler after the MNLF peace agreement. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about the less. I've also read that the agreements supposedly to be confirmed in September with the MILF are probably going to be pushed off. So just an overall view of what might happen there in the next 6 months, months or a year. Thank you.
Okay, and Gene, you can chime in anytime. I don't believe for any second that there will be a peace agreement in September, and people can make a bet with me on this, but I will bet it will not happen. I think that there are just bigger problems in the negotiations, particularly on the territory, the amount of territory that is to be allotted for the new Moro. They call it the Bangsa Moro juridical entity. Now, you ask about spoilers. What happens with this peace agreement, even if it's a good one? What is there to prevent spoilers? My answer is that there will be spoilers, and there may not be much to prevent them from spoiling the agreement, but your best chances are still to have a peace agreement. And I think they are on the right track because they've raised the most important issues, the legitimate grievances of the Muslims, the historical grievances, are being addressed. And in past peace agreements, these were swept under the rug. So I'm talking about the issue of recognizing what's been done to the Muslims, the loss of their lands, giving them the governance system that amounts to self-determination short of independence and giving them some control over economic resources. I think the actual substantive content of the negotiations is the best it's ever been and the most honest it's ever been. But given that they've had such a bad experience in signing agreements, the critical variable now is when this agreement is signed, who will look out for monitoring and implementation? And I have suggested that a group called the Friends of Mindanao assembled themselves with the U.S., Australia, Japan, the EU, and commit to 5 to 7 year presence there, not only presence to monitor, but also funding assistance for development and to engage very actively. Because I think without this, the chances are very high that the peace agreement will unravel. Now, the problem with armed groups is very serious in Mindanao. Often many of the violent incidents are due not to the fighting between Philippine Armed Forces and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, but due to clan warfare, personal rivalries. So, you know, 2 days ago, for example, there was a violent encounter between the MILF and a rival Moro group, the Moro National Liberation Front, and that was because the commanders of both groups had a personal rivalry going. So in addition to these groups, the NPA, the MILF, you have the militias, the CVOs, the civilian volunteer organizations, and the CAFGUs, the Citizens Armed Force Geographic Units. And although these groups who are armed and who are affiliated with the government, they're supposed to have a limited mandate. But once you give them these weapons, they often surpass their mandates. So for example, the CAFGUs are supposed to operate within a specified geographic unit, but nothing will stop them from going to the next municipality or the next town to fight a battle for their relatives. So I call all of this the mechanisms and instruments of violence, which are very widespread in the Philippines. And this will be there with or without a peace agreement. But what you want to see is a peace agreement. If you can demobilize 10,000 MILF, give them livelihoods, stabilize the situation, then you free up your resources to deal with these other things. Now, the toughest problem is the person at the top will have to have enough authority to tell the mayors and governors enough of these private armies. And I think that's the bigger challenge. I mean, you know, that's why I say the fear factor. Who will tell these people and make them fear enough what's going to happen to them and they're told to dismantle their militias?
You didn't mention one rather important thing in the political scene nowadays, and that's cha-cha, the
yes.
Constitutional change. I would like to toss out a proposition and then have you tell me why I'm wrong.
but I might think you're right.
basically, the proposition is that if something along this line goes through, it's going to be a disaster. And the reason I'm suggesting that is that basically, the structure of each form of democracy, whether it's congressional or presidential or whether it's parliamentary, there are different structures, and the different structures have different outcomes, different results that are determined by the structure itself. I don't see any evidence in the discussion in the Philippines that there's any awareness of this. It's very hard to sort out what the motives are of the people that are pushing for it, but as nearly as you can tell, the primary motive seems to be the present system isn't working. Let's try something different. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a recipe for disaster, so I hope you can prove me wrong.
I don't know if I can prove you wrong that it wouldn't be a disaster. I'm not sure I can say that. It is understandable why people are pushing for charter change. You know, the driving force behind that is politics are just so personality-driven and family-driven and unpredictable, and there's constant musical chairs. There's no political program that you can hold politicians accountable to. So that's what's driving them. And, of course, the local governments wanting more control. And in Mindanao, that's the case for the Moros and even the non-Moros in Mindanao. They want greater control. They feel they could have a more progressive, more developed region without this centralized system where they have to send everything back to Manila, or for shipping and other licenses, you always have to go back to Manila. It makes everything so costly, and the periphery suffers. And so that's what's driving them. And President Arroyo, I think, has supported this because she was in a political bind, and this was sort of a way of placating some of her critics. My own opinion, it is not going to go anywhere for a very long time, and it is not the solution to their problems, because we've experimented with various forms of government. So we had the unitary system, then we had martial law, then Marcos attempted a semi-parliamentary system. We had Prime Minister Cesar Virata, and then we had People Power 1, and then we had People Power 2, and then we have, a president serving 1.5 terms, overthrowing her predecessor, and now they want a parliamentary system. So I often tell my friends in the Filipino elite that what they have to do is think about more practical, functional solutions to problems on the ground without thinking of a massive overhaul of the system. Now, the Constitution does have to be rewritten, I think. This is part of charter change. We're talking about a revised constitution. And I do support many of the things that are in the draft revised constitution, such as, a more liberal, more competitive economic system, opening up the Philippines. I support all of that. But the method currently being envisioned in the draft constitution on how you come up with states in the Philippines, you begin with what they call ATs, autonomous territories, it's extremely cumbersome. And it's highly dependent on clans, again, families who rule provinces, deciding to get together and form a state. So what's different there? I'm not optimistic about that at all. And it's this multi-year period. And again, these families will be making deals amongst themselves to form a state and how they're going to control it. You know, in the Philippines, how do you break this stranglehold? And open up the system more politically and economically? These are two huge tasks, and I don't think charter change will solve it.
Let me just add a word, and I think one advantage of charter change is only, in my view, that the Constitution is now open for discussion.
Yeah.
Because previously the 87 Constitution was sacrosanct. It was Holy Scripture. Nobody could change it because it had been done after Marcos was overthrown. Now I think it's all on the table and everybody can consider different changes. Whether or not changes are necessary, that's a different matter, what changes there should be. But I think at least it's open now. And I think this gives also the negotiations with the Moros an advantage, because now they can talk about a real autonomy rather than a given autonomy by the central government, which is quite hollow.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not an expert on civil-military relations in Thailand. And what was the other country you mentioned? Indonesia? So I can't comment on a comparative basis. Maybe I can just comment on civil-military relations. And again, here Jean might have some insights. So the military there, anyone I think who analyzes the Philippine military and its relations with the civilian government will have to go back to the Marcos legacy. And Marcos used the military as a primary instrument of rule. And so there's always been that patron-client relationship with the military. And I think in part that's good. You know, it can help the president stay in power. They'll obey the president, but only as long as he or she acts as patron. In actual practice, you see that there are huge problems. Under Aquino, perhaps, was the worst. The worst period may have been under Aquino, where you had so many coups. And the problem is there's no accountability afterwards. You have, Gringo Honasan now, the general who led one of the biggest coups against Aquino, he's on the run now. But, he became senator. subsequent to having led a coup against the duly elected president of the Philippines. So there's a lot of precedent where the military, I think, are not tried properly, punished properly. And so there's always that temptation within the military. And in more recent times, you had the Magdalo group, that coup in Makati a couple of years ago. So there's always that repeated risk. And there are idealists within the military. It's often the young soldiers who will follow someone who wants to use them for a coup or a mutiny. So it is porous. The civilian control over the military is highly porous in my view. And it only holds as long as the person in power is able to placate them. So, for example, recently, the president has been giving more funding for military housing. It is worrisome. And I think I do support the professionalization of the military. So what the U.S. government does to help improve that is something that I would welcome. But I don't think we can ever conclude that, yeah, there is discipline there in civil-military relations. Evan, what do you think? I don't think so.
I'm Greg Rushford. I publish a newsletter called the Rushford Report on the economic side. The question on the moral national liberation front.
Yes. Okay, so for a little bit of history, the Moro National Liberation Front was the original Moro insurgency formed in the 70s, and the MILF is a breakaway group. So the Moro National Liberation Front at its height had 30,000-plus fighters. In 1996, when they signed the second major peace agreement called the Final Peace Agreement with Fidel Ramos, they were given the autonomous region in Muslim Mindanao, which had already existed. It was already there. It was formed under Corazon Aquino. This was given to them as the place that they would govern, so that Nur Misauri, the head of the MNLF, became the elected governor of the ARMM. Now, are they happy? Part of the deal in 1996 was that about 7,000 of them would be integrated into the military and into the Philippine National Police. And so some of that happened. A few of them were given livelihood, but not all of them. Others were taught to be seaweed farmers, trained to do that, given some of the initial capital with the help of the U.S. government and other donors. But overall, the ARMM is seen as an utter failure by most Moros. It was created by two organic acts of Congress, and its composition was decided by several plebiscites. They were promised originally to have 13 provinces and 9 cities, but over 4 plebiscites where Christians were also allowed to vote. The MNLF and the Moros then, by extension, got only 5 provinces and 1 city. It doesn't have a very strong budget. It doesn't have a strong economy to tax, so it is a beggar government. It has to go to Manila all the time for a budget, and the budget is erratic. And because the MNLF had to placate its own rebels and families, they employed everybody in the ARMM, so they have this bloated bureaucracy. Over 90% of the budget goes to paying salaries. Almost nothing is left for development, for building infrastructure. So it is really seen as a discredited government. In the current peace negotiations, the ARMM is to become the core of a new Moro entity. They don't call it an autonomy because they don't like the word autonomy. The ARMM will become the core, but more territories which are Muslim majority populated will be added on to the ARMM, whether these territories are contiguous or not. The question then here becomes, can this peace agreement correct the grievances that arose from the 1996 agreement so that both MNLF and MILF can finally say, we've got something solid here, worth all these years of negotiation, and we won't start, new rebellion? That remains to be seen. But the MNLF, I would say many are unhappy, and you see the fighting in Sulu that's led by remnants of the MNLF, and some of them have joined the MILF active guerrillas.
I would just add a word that I think the MNLF and the government can share responsibility for the failure, in my view, of the 96 agreement, because I think the MNLF approach was not what was needed either. Noor Misawari, whom I met several times when I was there, basically treated him, you know, felt he was the designated tribal chief, if you will, and was able
Sultan.
The Sultan, yes, even better, and that he could do what he wanted, and he did not really address the basic issues. And I think so the Congress took out all the guts of the agreement that they reached in the negotiating panels, and Noor Misawari took out the rest, so there wasn't much left. Yes, you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Martin. Yes, I'm Rita John Atkins of Philippine News. Could I ask you, Dr. Caminas, as to what, this is perhaps jumping to a more current issue, which has just been in the news, what do you think would be the impact of the death of Ms.
Zarqawi?
Zarqawi and others himself in Iraq, considering that he's suspected to be to have connection with Al-Qaeda. What do you think would be the impact of this on the problem in the Philippines, Australia, and Mindanao, and also throughout the region where they suspected that Al-Qaeda has some roots?
Okay, I mean, my immediate answer is that will have zero to no impact on the security situation in Mindanao. But I think underlying your question is a larger question about terrorism. The intelligence estimates are consistent that there are 28 to 30 Jamaah Islamiyah Indonesians, active terrorist elements in Mindanao, and some of them are allegedly sheltered by MILF commanders, and the MILF constantly denies this. They are said to be training in camps, but there are no camps. So, yeah, they may be in the jungle. We spoke with one lieutenant who had interviewed someone they'd arrested who'd become a recruit of JI and Al-Qaeda, and the recruit said, well, I was just sitting there. They said, can you guide us through the jungle? We'll give you so many 1,000 pesos for 2 days. He didn't realize he was becoming a recruit. It's a very, you know, when you read the media sometimes, you get this image in your head, there are camps. But all of the camps have been taken over by the Philippine Armed Forces. There are no camps. And I can obviously believe that some Moros who know these people might shelter them, or those who fought in Afghanistan. There's an estimated 300 to 600 Filipino Moro fighters who fought in Afghanistan and came back to Mindanao. But the reports are so conflicting. Just this week, a lieutenant general in Mindanao again said, we have a problem attacking the JI because they're sheltered by MILF commanders and we have to abide by the ceasefire. So that's just this week he says that. Then the superintendent of the police in Manila just had a press conference 2 days ago. He said, the terrorists are decimated. They're not there anymore. The camps are all gone. Our police enforcement has been very effective. What I would be very careful about is where you get information on these issues of terrorism, who's giving it to you. And I would also hold the police and military accountable for some of what's happening, because if the MILF has lost commands, so do the Philippine police and military. And the best example is Fatur Rahman Algozi, who in 2003 in the police headquarters in Camp Krame escapes. Between 12 midnight and 5 a.m., this guy disappears with a cell phone, makes his way from Manila all the way to Mindanao, and is conveniently shot a week before George Bush arrives to say they're fighting terrorism. So some major payouts have been given. The Sipadan abduction of scuba divers in 2000, where the Libya Muammar Gaddafi paid $25 million in ransom. And there have been so many reports about people in the military having received some of this money. And Gracia Burnham, who was abducted, if you remember, in 2001 from Dos Palmas in Malaysia, in the Philippines, in Palawan, in her memoirs also claimed to hear her Abu Sayyaf captors talking about the military giving them information so that they could escape. So, you know, it's two-pronged. You have to deal with the Moros, maybe, who may be supporting JI. You also have to deal very, very strongly with the military and the police.
I would add that the attraction of terrorism is because the Moros, or the people who support terrorism, have not gotten any kind of satisfaction to their basic grievances. if the basic grievances can be addressed and there is a sense that things will get better and that an agreement will be implemented. I think in Maoist terms, the water will dry up for the fish to swim in. And I think that what you have evidence of that is the ceasefire, which has lasted 3 years, has really made a big, at least it, for the first couple of years, made a big change in the attitude and the environment in Mindanao. People really began to feel that things were getting better and that they would have a peaceful future, and they were beginning to do business and do investment. And I think the longer it goes on without a peace agreement, the more people are going to get frustrated and the more opportunities I think that people like J.I. and Abu Sayyaf will have to recruit people who get impatient.
I would also mention that, you know, I never buy the argument that there are these Islamist ideologues in Mindanao. Okay, maybe you'll find two. But if you're familiar at all with Moro culture and the history, that is an argument that cannot be sustained intellectually, I think, or operationally. The issue of land, this grievance on land, is so much at the root of the conflict. That this is not, this is not that they want to build this Islamic caliphate in Southeast Asia. And certainly the missionary work of the Wahhabis done in the 80s and 90s has made some difference. You've seen kind of fundamentalist behavior as such, but that's separate, I think, from terrorist behavior. Another point that should be emphasized is that the MILF and the Philippine Armed Forces have a mechanism called the AJAG, or the Ad Hoc Joint Action Group, which took over a year to be activated, but it's active now. They've solved a lot of kidnapping incidents, for example, gotten hostages back, and this group is supposed to work also on going after criminal elements, including the Abu Sayyaf. I think working with them would be a very good way to advance the counter-terrorism effort. I am less sanguine about bombing, where our military, the U.S. military there, participates in what is called intel ops fusion. That's what they call it, where they provide the intelligence for where to bomb. And the reason that I don't support that is it is such a it's non-discriminate. It's a non-precision instrument. So you bomb the marshes, you say Dulmatin is there, or you say Gaddafi Janjalani is there, the head of the Abu Sayyaf, and then the next week these guys turn up somewhere else, but in the meantime you've killed 10 people, 12 people, 19 people. I think in the long term, your support on the ground just has no chance to grow very much because of these kinds of operations.
Anybody else? Yes, Patty? Trying to pursue national development within the democratic framework, and it's a very tough task.
The question, of course, yes, you're right. I've criticized the clans and dynasties, and yet on the other hand, the leaders that I said are good examples of those who could move the Philippines forward might be said to belong to this, the same clans and warlords. I have an somewhat unscientific approach to this, where I think in the Philippines you cannot really get rid of warlords and clans and dynasties very quickly. But I always argue that there's got to be some ratio that works better than other ratios, the ratio of stealing and competence. So there's a ratio there. You can steal 30% and be competent 70% of the time and give it back so that your economic pie grows. Unfortunately, many of the warlords and clans and dynasties steal, you know, 98%. And so that's the problem. I'm not some idealist who think tomorrow you can have this clean democracy. That really doesn't happen in real life. I mean, and I worked in Russia for a long time and saw the reforms there. And you see, you know, one step forward, two steps back. What I don't see in the Philippines, and I would criticize the elite there very strongly, is the sense of I don't feel the sense of either shame over what's happening in the country or a sense of some national consensus that this has got to be better. The dynamic of each clan for itself is just so strong and rooted, and maybe really that will not change for a very long time. I certainly am very open to that kind of outcome, that that's what we will see. Now, as for lessons for democracies in transition, yes, we have to be patient with this system. But I think in the meantime also, Filipinos have to speak up, because you can be patient, but the danger for the Philippines is that as a laggard, when does it catch up, if ever? You know, you look at Thailand, South Korea in the 50s and the Philippines, and then you compare the same countries today, and it's very difficult to feel that the Philippines is competitive with these countries. And yet, they started out with the Philippines even with some advantage decades ago. What I really worry about is there a vision, or is this country satisfied with being mired where it is? And one of the problems today is that I think the country doesn't feel enough pain. There's just not enough pain. As long as the spigot of OFW remittances continues to be open and pouring in the billions of dollars a year, the country isn't shaken enough. Often in transitions, you need either an internal variable to jolt you or an external variable. Okay, so the Soviet Union had Gorbachev, internal variable jolts the system. Reagan from the outside, the system has to change, to adapt. And in the Philippines, this is sort of the tough thing, the internal and external variables to jolt it into some kind of different track seem to be quite weak at this point.
Let me just add a quick footnote, and that is I think the Philippines is blessed and cursed by the same thing, and one is that the family loyalty or the clan loyalty. The family is a very important component. People identify and they support their families tremendously. At the same time, the loyalty is to the family, and anything you do to take care of the family is okay, whether it's corruption, whether it's stealing or what have you. And I think you need to, somehow or another, you have to overcome that dedication, not because families are not important, but because you need to also have a higher goal, if you will, or higher loyalty to the state or to the democracy or whatever it may be. Anyway. Go ahead. We can hear you.
Yeah, Eddie Lachica. I was wondering whether you have a sense of the parliamentary role of the left or the so-called progressive parties, and perhaps drawing on your own Russian studies. As I think it's a concern right now in the Philippines that the so-called left is a endangered species. You mentioned that there were 75 or 76 journalists were killed. But since the Arroyo administration started, I think the figure is 224 militants have been eliminated.
NPA militants?
These are mostly leftists, Bayan, Bayan Luna, Gabriela, kind of socialist progressive.
Above
groups.
Ground.
And the explanation you hear from the government is that this is an extension of the fratricidal conflict within the NPA itself. You adverted to that yourself. You know, the hunt for the five.
Ability afterwards. You have the deep penetration agents. Yes. Yes.
The story is that the so-called rejectionists the rejectionists are wreaking revenge.
Yes.
For the death of Tabara and so forth. Or is there a more sinister, insidious theory out there? Are there sort of lost commands going around dealing with this theory?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I just haven't looked closely enough. I hesitate to comment because I haven't looked closely enough at the NPA dynamics. I am aware of leftist activists being killed. And I would assume, you know, it is credible that some of that could be internal, but it also is even more credible that they're being killed by local politicians or military or the police. It's just not, I hesitate to say anything further because I haven't looked into the issue. Does anyone here know this better? But no, the idea of integrating the leftists into Congress, I think, was something that was started. That's why you have members of Congress who represent the left. But that, I think, again, just didn't go all the way. So as long as you have rebels there, and it's always fair game, as it was under Marcos, if you were sympathizer for the MPA, you may not be, but if you happen to be there, you know, you get killed. I don't know. I don't have anything better to say on the subject. Evan,
the Communist Party, I mean, communism is legal as an ideology. You can set up your party and it can run like everybody else.
Yeah. But do you have any insights on the killings, though, his specific question? Who's killing 200-plus leftist activists?
Okay, if there's no other questions, thank you all for coming. And Dr. Tomenes, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.